Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we take a close look at sickle cell disease. About 300,000 children are born with sickle cell disease every year, according to the World Health Organization. Many of them die before their fifth birthday, but observers say there is hope with early intervention and access to proper care. Patients with sickle cell may soon have two new treatments to try. Until recently, the only treatment options have been intensive bone marrow transplants from siblings or matched donors. A U.S. Food and Drug Administration Advisory Committee will review a new gene therapy for the painful inherited blood disorder. Issues they will consider include whether more research is needed into possible unintended consequences of the treatment. Now, the WHO says sickle cell disease is more common in certain groups, ethnic groups such as people of African descent, as well as of Middle Eastern, Asian, Indian, and Mediterranean descent. Either both parents must be carrier or one parent has to have the disease. The disease affects up to 3% of births in some parts of Africa. In Uganda, about 25,000 children are born with sickle cell disease and 80% don't live past their fifth birthday. Joining us via phone from Kampala, Uganda, for more is Daniel Roy Udo. He is Executive Director of Sickle Cell Rescue Foundation in Uganda. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure joining the Voice of America Radio. Thank you.
Let me start with the number. 25,000 children are born with sickle cell disease in your country, and 80% don't live past their fifth birthday. This is really disturbing. Let me have your thoughts on this.
Yes, thank you. For starters, it is quite evident that there seems to be an element that we have forgotten to sensitize and cause awareness to the public. And just like you have said in your introduction, it is also evident in a certain particular region of this country that, like, for example, northern Uganda has the highest prevalence of sickle cell disease at about 28% or 28.3%. Then you go to the eastern part of that country, then you come to the central and then western part of the country. These statistics of 25,000 children being born annually with sickle cell is quite true. And we have had lots of laxity amongst our stakeholders. For example, if you talk of the cultural leaders, the religious leaders, and also there are moments that I feel that we are not taking sickle cell very seriously until of recent, whereby we have woken up. Those days, you would only get to hear things related to sickle cell when it's the World Sickle Cell Day. But right now, it's a combined effort. Awareness and sensitization is ongoing. And through the Ministry of Health, we have also intensified on massive sickle cell screening across the entire country.
Okay. And Daniel, we're going to get more into some of the steps that your organization is taking to address this issue. I wanted to talk again about the data, right? You said that northern Uganda has the highest percentage of cases of sickle cell disease in Uganda as a whole. Is there a reason, is there a justification for the distribution of the rate? Do you know why?
Yes. One of them, there is a correlation between malaria and also sickle cell. So there is an element of mutation. Because if you not, it is very evident that northern Uganda, especially Alektong district, has the highest prevalence. Now, this brings you also to an area which has the highest prevalence of malaria in the country. But that aside, during the Cold War that ended in the early 2003, there were lots of people that migrated from from the villages and came into the town centers. So they ended up intermarrying between themselves without even knowing their sickle cell beta-cells. So a carrier and a carrier met and gave birth to a sickle. So this has been going on. Different clans, which are more or less of the same, they have been intermarrying in between that particular clan, and yet probably they are known for being carriers. So they end up giving birth to sickleers. And these statistics are quite alarming.
So when you look at the way people are aware or not aware, I know that your organization is making some steps, but to what extent do people understand the genetic aspect of sickle cell? Do they know that they have to get tested or they have to investigate before getting married to someone?
Okay. We have only 1% of the population that do know their sickle cell status. And we have been pretty much pushing for the fact that we have premarital testing before you go on to give birth to children, before you probably get married. Just like we have been doing it for HIV, before you get married in the church or any other traditional marriage, your HIV status is probably known. But for sickle cell, it is totally different. People tend to ignore it. When we sit in office, we have been receiving couples that come in to get tested for sickle cell, and probably they have their wedding in 1 or 2 weeks' time. And when we discover that they are carriers of sickle cell, now that's where now the complication comes in. They have gone ahead, they have done, they have probably paid for a certain activities. Now what is holding them is sickle cell test, and it turns out to be positive for both of them. So this is initially there is need for a deliberate action by different stakeholders, even government and parliament, to enact certain laws that before you get married, please get to know your sickle cell status. People only prioritize HIV. If we had the same approach for HIV, I'm very sure that our numbers would be going down by now.
You're making a good point when you talk about the way people approach HIV, and that could be helping the fight against sickle cell if they were having a similar approaches. Now, talk to us about the fact that many people ignore their status, right? And they get married, then they have children. What are the signs, the telltale signs, to indicate parents that the child may be having sickle cell anemia or sickle cell disease and they should get tested?
Okay. The first one, at about 3 months or 18 months, a child will present with lots of crying, and that indicates that there is a lot of pain. Then there are some swellings on the joints of the child, whether it is the fingers, the knees, and the toes. It becomes swollen. And then the child also becomes anemic. And leave alone that, the yellowing of the eyes, which we call jaundice. These are some of the evident signs that a parent should be in position to critically look at and then notify in a nearby health facility. And this is now being done across the entire country, unlike those days where sickle cell was associated to a witchcraft, or people probably think that one, if you have sickle cell, it is probably due to some bad omens or an outcast within the society. It is quite painful that, for example, we visited a certain family whereby the lady had given birth to 6 children and they all died at the age of 5, 6 there. So they decided to excommunicate her off from her family, and she left her marital home. Then eventually she went and got married to another man, and the man also got married to another woman. So they both get children at their respective places of marriages, and they now have children living. So when we heard of that, we had to go and test this man and the lady when they had separated, and we discovered that they were all carriers of sickle cell.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. So, yeah. So now talk to us about the awareness activities that the Uganda Sickle Cell Rescue Foundation has embarked on. How many years and what sorts of impact have you seen? Let's talk about the program and activities first, and then we'll get into the impact.
Okay, fine. As Uganda Sickle Cell Rescue Foundation, we have been very key in carrying out sickle cell awareness. Normally, every year since our inception in 2013, we organize sickle cell conferences where we have different presenters and participants, patients and caregivers be coming to attend and then get key vital information about sickle cell. For example, last month, in the month of September, we had a sickle cell conference that was bringing together a number of nurses from the northern part of the country that we got them and discussed how best can we handle sickle cell, because we believe that nurses are the first point of entry or point of care at any hospital that these sicklers do go to. And this has been going on and on and on. We also do community outreaches, and in these outreaches we have sickle cell testing totally free of charge, and this is supported by our philanthropists and local businessmen around the country. For example, BMK Group, which has Hotel Africana, Roofings Group, AGT, and quite a number of other partners that do come in and support some of these interventions. We also have instant counseling services. We have a 24-hour dedicated telephone number and WhatsApp. We also have WhatsApp groups which have caregivers across the country where we do share experiences. But for example, if my child is feeling this and this way, how can I respond? And this is yielding quite a number of results.
So, that's fantastic. And let's talk about treatment in the assistance that you provide, because according to reports, the only treatment options have been intensive bone marrow transplants from siblings or matched donors. So how is sickle cell being managed?
Yes, with the support from the Ministry of Health and other partners, for example, right now we have hydroxyurea, which is actually changing the game of how sickle cell is being responded to in terms of care and treatment. This is a life-changing medication that reduces on the episodes of pain, on the crises, and also reduces on the frequency of blood transfusion on the sicklers. And this is still yet a challenge because we have always been given in terms of donations from Novartis and other pharmaceutical companies. And recently, or about a week ago, we just launched a bone marrow transplant center in Uganda by the Joint Clinical Research Center. And we believe that this has come in quite handy. We now believe that a bone marrow transplant will be conducted in Uganda at a much more reduced cost, because initially most of these patients used to travel to India, Belgium, and other parts of the country to do bone marrow transplant. But now this is going to be done in the country. And this is quite a very good step, which has been taken on by a number of partners. Earlier on, you had talked about gene therapy.
Yes, I was going to ask your reaction about that.
Yes, this is still work in progress. Certain studies are being conducted in the country, and this is still under Joint Clinical Research Center, which is championing this. And we believe that this will be sp- spread across the different centers of excellence for treating sickle cell across the entire country. But some of these technologies are work in progress for us now in the country.
Okay, Daniel, we have to leave it there. Do you have any final thoughts before we say goodbye to you?
Oh, yes. Sickle cell has affected almost everybody, directly and indirectly. Just yesterday, we have been losing quite a number of sicklers because they are now sitting for their final examinations for advanced level. Some of them are passing off before sitting for their exams. And if you know anybody who has sickle cell around you, you who is listening to this particular program, please hug them for me and tell them all is well. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Daniel Roy. We appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure.
That was Daniel Roy Odor. He is Executive Director of Sickle Cell Rescue Foundation in Uganda. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. The World Health Organization warns of mounting disease outbreaks, malnutrition, and rising cases of untreated non-communicable diseases. It reports cholera, measles, dengue, and malaria are circulating in several states, and Sudan's health system is stretched to breaking point. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Since conflict erupted April 15th, more than 4.6 million people have become displaced inside Sudan. This number, added to the more than 3 million who already were displaced within the country before the conflict, makes Sudan home to the world's largest internally displaced crisis. The World Health Organization warns the health system in Sudan is stretched to the breaking point and does not have the capacity to deal with the mounting health needs afflicting this enormous, vulnerable population. WHO representative in Sudan, Nima Saeed Abid, speaking from Port Sudan today, says health care is limited. Because of insecurity, he says 70-80% of health facilities are non-functional in conflict hotspots. He told journalists that displacement and shortages of medicines and medical supplies are placing millions of Sudanese at risk of severe illness or death from preventable and treatable causes.
Mass displacement have driven the population further into a state of widespread malnutrition, with the lives of children hanging in the balance. Cholera, measles, dengue, and malaria are circulating in several states, and a combination of any of these with severe acute malnutrition can be lethal.
WHO reports 3.4 million Sudanese children under 5 are acutely malnourished, and 700,000 are suffering from severe acute malnutrition, which can lead to death. Abid says outbreaks of cholera have been declared in Gedaref, Khartoum, and South Kordofan states, with suspected cases reported from Al Jazeera and Kassal states.
And there is possibility of further expansion because of the quality of water supply, because of the sanitation, and because of displacement, and the healthcare system in Sudan now is really at the breaking point. So for all these reasons, we are expecting that we may see more state affected, more people affected.
As of last week, WHO reports 1,962 suspected cholera cases, with 30 lab-confirmed cases and 72 associated deaths. It estimates more than 3.1 million people are at risk of cholera until the end of December. Abid says WHO has deployed 14 rapid response teams into the affected areas. He says WHO has stockpiled drugs and essential supplies for the treatment of cholera patients and is getting ready to receive oral cholera vaccines. Lisa Schlein, VOA News, Geneva.
As South Sudan commemorates the International Day for Disaster Risk Reduction, some South Sudanese affected by flooding are asking the government to create an emergency fund to be able to respond to humanitarian disasters such as floods. One victim of flooding, Amor Tabi, urges the South Sudan government to educate communities in area prone to annual flooding about how to mitigate the impact. Viola Elias reports from Juba.
28-year-old Amor Tabi, a survivor of flooding in Jonglei State, says her family lost property during last year's flooding. She says people affected by recent floods are finding it difficult to rebuild their lives.
So it was really very difficult for people like us, and it really affected us. Starting from scratch again for you to build your house, to buy everything, to do this thing, as you know, in South Sudan, life is hard. So it was really a bad experience and really affected us.
Tabi urges the government to respond to humanitarian disasters across the country. She says the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs should educate communities affected by floods how to tackle potential humanitarian disasters.
We have a lot of disasters that can happen, and people are not always ready for it. So it's good the government should always be prepared for disasters, not disaster to come and they are like, we don't have resources to do these things.
Albino Akolatak, South Sudan Minister of Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management, says his ministry lacks sufficient funds to respond to the long-term humanitarian crisis in the country.
There is no long-term funding for disaster risk activities. That's one of the issues that we are now struggling to have a long-term funding, because for us to build this system in place, we need long-term funding for these activities. There are too many actors practicing disaster risk reduction with no or limited coordination, which creates implementation constraints.
South Sudan Vice President in charge of the government gender and youth cluster, Rebecca Nyandeng, says the government needs to involve local communities in any projects aimed at addressing humanitarian crises across the country.
Disaster response need to involve local people. Communities have a wealth of valuable skill and knowledge to offer. Working closely with local people helps them develop the skills to handle future disasters.
Nyadeng says psychosocial support should be included in programs geared towards healthy and resilient communities.
We need to invest in trauma healing programs, provide counseling services, and raise awareness about mental health support, which are critical steps toward building more robust and resilient communities. Through this holistic approach, we can create a foundation for long-term disaster risk reduction.
Titus Osulade, the Deputy Resident Representative of the United Nations Development Programme, or UNDP, says the country is in the process of establishing an early warning system to detect climate focus. He says the system would help farmers make decisions on their agricultural projects.
The country will be able to undertake accurate and reliable climate forecasts and predictions in any area in the country to better guide and inform farmers adopting climate smart agriculture of the changing rainfall and climate patterns. It will also be able to inform humanitarian development agencies of potential disaster risk and events in order to better inform prevention, mitigation, and preparedness measures.
October 13 is the International Day for Disaster Risk Reduction. South Sudan Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management commemorated the day 2 weeks later under the theme Fighting Inequality for a Resilient Future. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
Now to Cameroon, where the separatist conflict, now in its sixth year, has left thousands of people dead, while an estimated 2 million survivors struggle with emotional wounds. In Bafoussam, the capital of Cameroon's west region, a trauma healing center is overwhelmed with requests for help. And Nzoanke has the story, narrated by Moki Edwin Kinzeka.
Every other week, Aminatu Musa goes to a speech therapy session organized by the Mission 21 Trauma Healing and Resilience Center. She's in her third session and still can't talk without crying. In 2018, Musa and her husband fled the conflict between government forces and separatist militant groups in Western Cameroon, heading for Nigeria. But along the way, she says her husband fell ill and died. Musa says that for nearly a year, she has not been able to sleep.
Most of the times when I come to center,
most
like this,
of the time when I come to the center, I feel
like
better. When I come to a meeting like this and I go back, I'll sleep a bit. After a while, the sleep will just disappear again.
The healing process begins with therapy in groups of up to 20 people. After that, therapists hold individual sessions with patients. Mission 21, a Swiss non-governmental organization, also organizes home visits. The center offers material assistance, but therapist Esther Mokong says that kind of aid is of limited help.
If you give me a business when I'm hurting, I will not do anything with that business. So when you heal me first and I'm fine and I'm relaxed, I can now be able to do something.
When Vanessa Ngang was 20, the crisis began and her husband was killed by the separatists. She spent 5 years battling illness and unemployment. After 3 months of treatment, she was able to start a new life in a sewing workshop.
So, they were fine.
I feel good. I learned a new skill and graduated. They opened my sewing shop. I thank Mission 21 for this initiative to care for people. From time to time, I still have memories of the past, but I am fine.
But I am fine. When I go back, I cry. I come back, I am fine.
Country coordinator Togo Lumumba Mukong says Mission 21 conducts about 120 counseling sessions per month, but demand is 3 times as high. He says the NGO wants to not only add specialists to its office, but also find a suitable solution for each family.
We think that we, as Mission 21, we cannot do anything without others. So we need local NGOs, we need even the willingness of the IDPs to work with us, and then we put our hands together, then we can all come out of this trauma, which is ongoing.
According to the UN, Cameroon's separatist conflict, now in its 6th year, has left thousands of people dead, while an estimated 2 million conflict survivors are seeking help to continue their education or find work. For Anne Zwanke in Bafoussam, Cameroon, Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News.
VOA. VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. We thank our guest, Daniel Roy Udor, Executive Director of the Sickle Cell Rescue Foundation in Uganda. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu, in Washington, with producer Kwame Ofori. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.